Hey, this is Ninja Consultant.
Wait, are we on?
Yeah, we're on.
Okay, rockin'.
This is Ninja Consultant show 50-something.
57.
I don't think it's 57.
No,
I don't think we haven't done 50 yet,
getting close. Frankly.
I've been looking at ways to fix the feed so that we can have actual archives, and I bought a Libsyn account. So hopefully when I get that sorted out and whatever, paste into some crap, then we'll have real archives, not like our fake show now.
Right.
This show is going to be show number 41.
Oh.
So in only 10 more shows, 12 more shows, we'll have a year's worth of shows, even though we've been doing this for 2 years.
Yeah.
That's the long and short of it.
Yep. Now, this is the theory show.
Yes.
From Japan.
But first, we're going to respond to some voicemails.
Right, which are timely.
Yes.
But this is actually a show that's about Japan and Takarazuka.
Okay.
Now, let's answer some voicemail.
Here's Sora's voicemail.
Hey, man, this is the Sora from the Landing Station podcast, and I just got finished listening to your Super Show Part 2. And I was wondering, since you were in Ginza, I was wondering if that you saw the Ginza Cozy Corner, which I mentioned in one of my earlier shows as being evil and eating babies and such, because, yes, they are evil and eat babies. Hope you had fun.
No, we did not go to the Ginza Cozy Corner.
Wait, maybe we did.
No, because we were only in Ginza for a little while.
I know, it was a very sad day.
And we didn't eat there. Ginza's terrible, don't go there. But, but read Club 9, because it's awesome. Also,
right.
If you were staying in a hotel in Ginza, your family's rich. Wait.
Oh, snap.
He has an iPod, and he's in, like, sixth grade. Of course his family's
not rich. In sixth grade anymore. Now he's graduated from college.
Because in 1 year, because he's a genius.
He is a genius.
Now we're going to
listen. He's a child prodigy.
Now, Anime World Order has been shoveling off their listeners on us.
Oh, snap!
With unanswerable questions, so we're going to listen to that right now.
Hey, Aaron, Noah. My name is Malin, and I'm calling to you because Anime World Order told me to call you guys because I had called in during my spring break to ask what types of anime should I show to my younger 10-year-old sister, who wants to get into anime, and they were having a very, very hard time, and they told me to call you guys. So here I am. She's already watching Cardcaptor Sakura and Azumanga Daioh and Sailor Moon. She's seen a little bit of Princess Tutu. AWO recommended Full Moon Oshigatsute and a couple others, Magical Girl S and, you know, the Ghibli movies. And I was wondering, maybe, if you have any suggestions, she wants something funny, a little bit of action, but she wants something with cats in it, and I have no clue, because I'm not a furry girl, but anyway, please, 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 please help me. Anyway, thank you. Goodbye.
All right, I listened to the AWO episode where they answered this, and they did a pretty good job, but they forgot one title that's very important that all fifth graders should watch. It's Kodocha. Kodocha no Omacha. There aren't really cats in it,
there's
but...
a squirrel. That's kind of like a
that's
cat.
That's right. There's a squirrel who lives in the girl's mother's hair.
Yep.
But that is a totally enjoyable show that, like, it's about a sixth grader, and I think it's really appropriate for that audience, and it's a great show.
Yeah. It has one of the best openings in the history of anime, if you ask me.
Ooh, I don't think it's included on the American release, do you?
Oh, Scott. Ah, all right.
But you can watch that on YouTube or
me.
Something.
Yeah.
But you can find the commercial DVDs, like a few box sets around now. We haven't watched the end of the series yet, because it's pretty long.
Yeah.
But it'll keep your sister busy for a while.
But they mentioned all-purpose cultural cat girl Nuku Nuku on AWO.
No,
they
forgot about it.
Oh, well.
Is that appropriate for fifth graders?
Yeah, for fifth graders?
Yeah,
I think so.
There's
I think
like
so.
There's kind of younger stuff going on.
And it's, I don't know, it's certainly not one of my favorite shows, but as an introduction to anime, and there is a cat girl in the title and in the titular line.
Indeed.
And it's okay. It's all right.
Yeah, I think the reason I didn't watch more of it was because it was aimed a little too young.
Yeah.
Where I was like, yeah, I would watch this if it was on after school, but it's not. So.
Yeah, and it also, it's an okay story, and it has a, like, a legitimately happy ending, as I recall.
Yeah.
Like, a very satisfying conclusion.
Oh, okay. I wanted to second AWO's suggestion that your sister watch Sherlock Hound, which is another show that, even though it's not necessarily about cats, that I think is really good for younger kids. And it's,
right.
And you wouldn't hate it either. It's a decent show. And I think the DVDs have come down in price a bit on that, so it should be able to find, and there's Miyazaki tie-in there, too. The obvious answer is, unfortunately, Tokyo Mew Mew, which they did mention on their show, and it is on Fox Kids and is widely accessible because all of the characters are some kind of cat, and it's also a magical girl show like the other, like Sailor Moon or Cardcaptor Sakura. Unfortunately, it's unwatchable for our age group. So the people who watch it in Japan are either little girls or old guys.
Yeah.
So it's got that
horribly perverse.
It's got that
perverse. Well, we find that, in fact, that's much anime in Japan.
Now, there's a bunch of shows about witches that are probably totally appropriate for fifth grade girls. Like, Magical Do-Re-Mi got imported, but no one in our age group knows about it.
Wow, I don't know about that.
It's another Fox 4 Kids show. There's this one anime series that's huge in Japan, and that might actually be what it translated into.
Mm.
There's another show about witches that came over a few years back, and it came out in 2002, and I don't remember what it's called either.
But it's Magic Users Club.
It's like three... No, no, no. It's got three girls, four witches, and it's got an interesting art style.
Oh.
And the show's about 15 minutes long.
Tweenie Witches?
Yes.
It's Tweenie Witches.
Tweenie Witches. Or something.
Tweenie.
I think the title...
Clearly that's a translation.
They might have translated it different when they actually imported it. I don't think there are cats in it necessarily. And there's another witch show. Okay. Sugar Sugar Rune is for little girls, and Del Rey has imported the manga. I don't think the anime is licensed, but you could watch it again on YouTube or something like that. And that is another show about teen witches that your sister will probably enjoy.
Wow.
It's her age group.
You just cleared an entire category of Anime Jeopardy there, I think.
Or something. And the other one that I just learned about that I have never seen or read is called What's Michael? And it's by the creator of Club 9, which I wrote a review of
recently. Now, this is just manga, right?
No, there's an anime series.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen it. It's kind of older. I don't know if you'll be able to find it or not. But the manga was imported by Dark Horse in their Super Manga Blast magazine in America. And I think there are a couple, collected volumes of it that you should be able to find somewhere on the internet. And that is about a cat, I think, in the way that, like, Heathcliff was about cats, where it's just sort of like cats doing human stuff.
Right.
And it's supposed to be really funny.
No one should terrorize the neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah.
Heathcliff, no one should.
That's how it goes.
Yes.
I presume that AWO mentioned, Maylin said, Ghibli.
Yes.
Studio Ghibli.
They said
all Ghibli
movies. Especially,
Whisper of the Heart
has
cats
yes.
featured prominently.
Oh, and the cat
as
returns.
Does the cat returns.
And finally Kiki's Delivery Service with Tom
yes.
Cat. So if you get those three movies for your
that's
system,
the trifecta.
That's just
the triumvirate.
Busy. Yeah, the
Trinity of Ghibli.
Also,
films.
As long as your sister is watching Sailor Moon, there is one Sailor Moon movie that is primarily about Luna, her cat, and Luna becomes a character in that scene, and I think it's just heartwarming.
I guess. That's one of my least favorite of them all.
Okay, no, I wouldn't like it at all. But I think
but,
it's right.
I'm not the intended audience.
It's your sister's cup of tea.
Yeah.
Pretty much. All right, that's it.
Yeah,
I think so we're going to move
chew on that.
And talk about what did we learn from Takarazuka. And I'm going to say what I learned first, because Noah has a lot to say and he's going to go on about it. And I'm just going to let him talk until it's like midnight. And then I'm going to start cutting him off until he's done.
Oh, whatever.
All right. Should we say again what Takarazuka is? Or
probably, but
it?
Now my question first is Takarazuka or Takarazuka? Because I'm going to say Takarazuka because I think it sounds...
Takarazuka.
Takarazuka.
I don't know what emphasis the syllable is.
All right, who knows? But that's what we're saying. If we pronounce it incorrectly, sure, send us hate mail.
Tetsu, you pronounce it this way, right?
I think so, but he may have just been humoring us with the way he was Japanese. But no, go on. Don't let me interrupt you.
So we saw Takarazuka play, and Takarazuka is, of course, the theater company in just outside of Osaka, or possibly in Osaka. No, it's in the town of Takarazuka.
Yes.
It's an all-girl theater company, and they perform Western musical plays. And if you've watched Orin High School Host Club, there's an episode where the neighboring all-girl school, they have a Takarazuka thing going on that's direct parody. And that's the most direct anime thing that relates to it, except for...
Sakura Taisen.
Yeah, in a video game based on it. And that's the same kind of thing, where it's an all-woman opera company?
Yes.
All right. In the Takarazuka format, there's, like, a musical review, and also a very short play, apparently.
Right.
In the show that we watched, it went like that.
But you're leaving out the most salient point of Takarazuka theater, which is women play men's roles.
I said that at the beginning.
You said it's an all-women theater company.
True. Okay.
Women play men's roles and have been specially trained to do this.
Right.
And the training is apparent.
And they're picked from the beginning. They all audition for the theater. It's really, really hard to get into. You have to be single to get in. You can't be married. Maybe you can't have a boyfriend. I don't even know if they specify that or not. They have to be young, and you're picked from the audition group to either play forever from that moment on all girls' roles or all male roles, and you're trained differently depending on which one they pick you for. So the girls are very girly in the plays, and the girls who are playing men's roles are acting extremely manly.
Yeah, I'm not entirely certain that that's totally true. I think that there is some crossover. Some people enter playing women's roles and then get culled from those roles and are later trained to play men's roles. There are people who are brought in just to play female roles.
Did you read up on this?
The female lead. Huh?
Did you read up on this?
No, but we talked to Tetsuya.
Well, yeah. Then how come I remember a different answer than you?
This happens constantly, all the time, every day.
So the girls playing men's roles, they end up more famous than the girls who play
women's roles.
Yes, this
is certainly true.
So to graduate from Takarazuka, what we heard was that some people do go on to become like TV talent or pop stars. A lot of them will sell a lot of albums if they become one of the more famous cast members. But it's usually the girls playing men's roles that become much more famous than the girls playing girls' roles.
Absolutely.
Now, if we're to believe our friend Tetsuya, it used to be, back in the day, at the end of each train line in Osaka, there was some kind of theater troupe, and each of them had a weird shtick as soon as the train lines were built to get you to pay the full fare, because you pay by distance, to go out to the end of the line and watch something. And there were even maybe other all-girl theater companies. I'm not specifying enough for you anyway. The other ones kind of died out. Takarazuka is the one that survived, for reasons that I'm sure Noah will get into later, but I want to explain the most important point that I learned from the end of the one-act play that came up, where our friend Tetsuya pointed out, in a Japanese-style love story, it's beautiful to wait, or to wait is beautiful.
Be patient is a beautiful ending.
And that is something that drives home so many points from so much anime romance and manga romance that I've ever read. Just that when someone, like, they're ready to confess their love to whoever it is they're in love with, and they waited for a really long time to give their note. And as an American, when I see a storyline like that, I just think, what a creepy stalker. Like, if you feel that way about someone, you should probably ask them out soon. I don't know. For me, like, crushes I had in my childhood, if I didn't act on them, they'd just go away in a little while anyway. So my method would be to strike while the iron is hot. Unless it's someone you probably shouldn't have a crush on, and then you should kind of wait for it to go away.
Maybe. But maybe. I learned this.
So if you're going to lust after someone for a long time in this unrequited way, maybe that's cool in the Middle Ages, but nowadays it's just kind of weird. I think if the longer you wait to ask someone out, the more awkward it will be for you, and the more crushing it will be when they turn you down.
Right, unless you're Japanese, friend becomes a romantic stereotype.
The point of this is, that means that every time in anime or manga, when we find out that someone has loved someone for a super long time and never fucking did anything about it, it's supposed to be oh so beautiful.
Right.
Their heart is pure because they waited. Or indeed, in the movie that we just watched, The Girl Who Left Through Time, when the guy says to wait, no spoilers, but
right.
When some dude says to her, you don't know which one, wait for me, it's supposed to be beautiful and not a big problem. Since we're talking about time travel here. But I don't think that's, even in the movie, another live action movie I just watched was Year One in the North, and I have a few cultural notes to say about that that maybe I'll get to eventually. But this guy in the movie, part of the plot is, so these samurai are sent to settle Hokkaido in a part of it that's not really populated, and it's far from Sapporo, as everything in Hokkaido is. The village is dying, and one of the head samurai is like, he says to his wife, I'm going to go to Sapporo, and I'm going to get help. And so she waits for him for a really long time. Like, we're talking 4 years here. And part of the movie hinges on that you have to believe that she did the beautiful thing to wait. The other people in the town, they gave up on him, they thought he was dead. They didn't believe it anymore, even his own daughter. But his wife is the real hero because she held out for him. And she sewed him a new kimono every year in the spring, like good housewives do, apparently, in those days. But she waited, and that's beautiful. And I think in that film, it's kind of, in the text, it makes sense internally to watch in a way that doesn't necessarily always come through in anime and manga, where it's just assumed that you, the viewer, know that waiting is beautiful.
Right.
Whether your husband's going to war or something or traveling through time or might be dead. If you wait for someone, apparently that's supposed to be very beautiful.
And this, I think that, well, just what struck my mind just right now in Naruto. Mm-hmm. You have
Sakura's waiting for Sasuke.
Sasuke, who is a crazy psychopath. right?
Right, and he's joined the bad guys, but she's still waiting for him, even after the 3-year time gap, and that's supposed to be beautiful. Although, to a sane person, that is stupid.
Right. To a sane person in America.
She should probably give up on him. He's a bad guy now. Like, she could save him as her friend, but romantically, she could probably move on with her life.
Or, as I think we've mentioned before, Planetis has a very similar sort of ending.
Hachimaki's his mother?
Yes.
Right. Her husband is an astronaut. And it's very beautiful that she waits for him for years at a time when he travels off in deep space travel.
In comparison with American culture, which is immediate gratification, this is delayed gratification, but fetishized to an extreme. Because this is not like, oh, I have to wait 2 weeks. This is, I have to wait an indeterminate amount of time.
Maybe
and the very
trip to Jupiter is, what, 8 years?
Yeah, I think it was 7 years.
Seven-year trip to Jupiter.
So the very fact that it is an indeterminate amount of time and that my faith is put to the test to such an extent, it demonstrates that it is even more sublime. It is like the pain that is experienced from this longing is even more romantic. That, to me, as an American, of course, or maybe just as myself, this seems horrendously unhealthy. This is to say that...
Are you a doctor?
No.
Are you a doctor?
I'm not a doctor. No, I'm not a doctor.
Do you have a medical degree?
I do not have a medical degree, nor a mansion, nor a yacht. It seems to me that if all of your effort is not in the gratification, but in the absence of gratification, what is that?
What about medieval love stories and stuff?
Well, certainly in chivalrous love, as it, at least as I understand it, I'm not like an Arthurian scholar, although I've recently read up on it for D&D purposes, but never mind that. Usually a knight who was in love with a lady, the lady would not know who he was, would be literally in some kind of ivory tower, perhaps. He may glimpse her at feasts, he may see her at tournaments, but she certainly doesn't know who he is. And he writes epic love poems, which are never actually meant to be delivered. It is the act of writing them and not delivering them that is considered virtuous. And indeed, if she pays him the slightest mind, perhaps glances at him or nods, that is a moment of elation. And the greatest thing that can ever happen in sort of chivalric love is for the lady to perhaps give him her handkerchief.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's never going to be returned because of the class structure.
Yeah.
There's no hope for any kind of actual romantic love. Even if somehow through some twist of fate, if the knight were to marry his lady, it would turn into a sort of normal domestic love.
It's not very fun.
That's not very romantic and not very virtuous at all.
I think it's also important to throw it into context at this point that marrying for love is a 20th century invention.
Yes,
absolutely. Starting in the 1920s when kind of modern life begins, that's only then do people even really consider the possibility of marrying for love.
And you go back through the annals of history and find that for the longest time, love was considered non-ironically as a type of madness. This was something that would throw households into disarray, would cause an enormous amount of trouble for everyone involved. And so generally, the culture came down. I don't know. I don't want to say it's universal, but I think it's certainly true in classical culture and in antiquity. That being, you know, Greek, Roman, Persian, Egyptian. And again, I don't mean to make such broad generalizations, but on the whole, I think that we've only really embraced it. And the idea of love conquering all, we've come quite a ways from Romeo and Juliet, where it's a tragic love story because it's not really gratified, right?
Well, I'd also like to say, though, in a more modern context, that arranged marriages, when it comes to Japanese society specifically, even today, you can still get an arranged marriage there.
Yes.
For Japan, as well as anywhere else, probably they modernized more in the 50s. They might have been more marrying for love, or even, I guess, in the 40s. But even today, you could still get an arranged marriage if you wanted to. And the idea being with arranged marriages around the world and in history that love is something that comes later, that hopefully you will come to love your
right,
wife.
Right.
That you'll grow together over time.
If not, please bear with it. Because this
she's gonna have to take it.
This is your.
There are a lot of the other reasons for marrying someone are like for societal purposes to join two families,
right?
Mostly for reproductive purposes,
right?
To continue your line, for financial purposes, if you get a dowry with your bride, or for like a work service thing, if the wife is going to work in terms of family, then like an anthropological way,
or business ties.
Business ties.
There are a number of
very
different.
Very popular.
In fact, what most recently was it that we watched where that was?
They wanted the people to hook up because of
their businesses. Because where that I think was sort of the reveal at the end that it turned out that their parents were both in on it. I forget now, but
I don't
so yes. Romantic love has really only been embraced very recently in terms of, you know, the idealization that it's a good thing and that love conquers all. Oh, in fact, we actually know someone who, well, you...
That one guy we know.
You remember better than
right,
I do, I think.
Right, where her parents, this Japanese woman, found out that she was who she was dating, this American guy we know. And when they found that out, they presented several photos of other potential guys, Japanese guys, whom she might wish to consider marrying, because that's what Japanese parents do. And she was just like, no, I don't think so.
But she went out on a date with one of them.
There's a word for that, and I don't remember.
And she said it was horrible. He was
not human.
He was a mathematician.
And like a math professor.
Yeah.
That was too much for her.
It was, it didn't work out. So she ended up marrying an American and moving to New Jersey. So watch out for that. I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
At some point...
She now has two kids.
At some point, we should talk about the deadly culture clash going on in Asia about how white guys end up with Japanese girls and exactly why. But I don't think... Not in this show.
Oh, that's too much.
Topic.
And we strayed from Takarazuka.
Maybe we'll hit that on a show about racism. But we're going to talk about Takarazuka and important themes that no one learned from the story.
Oh, are you done with your part?
Oh, yeah, way done.
Oh, awesome. Because I talked all over that. Sorry about that. Anyway, I have... Some background, I'll let it slip. I have some background in musical theater and as a film student in shut up. You watch your mouth. As a film student, I had a certain amount of time spent in class analyzing musicals, American musicals. American musicals from the 50s, in fact, I think, almost entirely. I think in American musical theater, there's two styles of song and dance. There's the Fred Astaire style and the Gene Kelly style. The Fred Astaire style, and I hope everyone listening to this has some sort of background. You know who Fred Astaire is.
No, good Lord, fifth graders. Which movie Gene is Fred Astaire in? He was in like a Hoover commercial or something recently.
What?
Yeah. Posthumously.
All right. Yes, posthumously perhaps. Fred Astaire.
And Gene Kelly is the one in
Gene
Singing
Kelly
in the
Rain. And Fred Astaire were dancing
you don't
partners.
Have to explain who they are. Just give a single movie that Fred Astaire was in.
Good God, I don't know. I mean...
But I can give a single movie that Gene Kelly was
in.
Yes,
well, it's easy.
Singing in the Rain.
Right. That's because I think that perhaps Gene Kelly has survived longer.
Well, we can't name a single Fred Astaire movie off the top of our heads.
All right,
I'll hit the internet.
Hand.
You go ahead.
All right, go ahead. Try and find out something that he's known for. He was in a lot of dance films that were, as far as I'm concerned, all the same. I can't think of anything that really stood out from his oeuvre. But there's a reason for this, which I'm about to get into. Fred Astaire has a very austere style of dancing. That is to say, he's frequently in a spotlight, he's in a top hat and fancy dress, and he sort of glides across the stage. And the Fred Astaire way of dancing is to make the dance look effortless. You know it's not. Clearly the man put a lot of time and effort into studying dance moves and getting everything perfect. But his delivery and the choreography is to make him look as though he's completely natural. And it comes across very well. When he dances with
Ginger Rogers,
she is always in the sort of subservient role to him. He is always leading.
Oh, but some people say Ginger Rogers, better dancer since she has to do all the same moves as Fred Astaire, but backwards.
Yes, that's... I've heard that. Incidentally, just as an aside, Fred Astaire's first audition, I believe, the judge or producer, whoever it was, wrote down on the card, with his name. Can't sing, can't act, can dance a little. So maybe that gives some hope to some aspiring dancers out there or whatever. This is in contrast to Gene Kelly, who was...
Ziegfeld Follies, the movie, 1946.
Okay, Ziegfeld Follies, I should have thought of that. Gene Kelly is the exact opposite.
Ooh, Daddy Longlegs, 1955.
Okay, yeah.
Funny face?
Gene Kelly is athletic, he sweats and grunts, and it's all effort. You see beads of sweat flying off of his head. He dances with objects. His sleeves are rolled up. If you are on stage with him, and this is very important, if you're on stage with him, you're also dancing. Fred Astaire, he's in the spotlight. You're in the audience. You're watching him. The stage is empty except for him and
Ginger Rogers.
Sometimes. He does a lot of solo dance as well. Gene Kelly, totally macho. He's always got... You can see sweat stains under his armpits. You can hear him grunt. And if you're on stage with him, he's pulling you into these not very intricate necessarily, but incredibly athletic dances.
What's the other Gene Kelly movie that has like a ballet in Paris, but it's like fake Paris? And
anyway,
maybe we should mention at this point that one reason we're talking about these famous dancers from American film and theater is that Tokarczuk is mostly about the dancing. Like, it's a musical review, and yes, they're singing, but... There's a lot of dancing.
Yes.
And this will become important towards the end.
But this is not the only reason why I'm discussing these two dancers. They represent two extremes of the male spectrum, in America at least, of the male spectrum of dance.
Okay.
Where it's either super elegant or super macho. Tokarczuka is both.
What about the all-male Swan Lake?
Well, you're talking ballet, not musical theater. Tokarczuka takes... the super machismo and cranks it up. It's astounding, the body language of these actresses.
They strut out onto the stage like there's something in their pants.
And they are entirely phallocentric. I mean, there's no question that these are strapping young lads ready for a tussle. And if someone approached me with the body language...
Oh, the answer is An American in Paris.
An American in Paris. All right, I've never seen it.
I've seen it on, like, American Movie Classics or something. It's really something, and there's, like, a 40-minute dance
number. I believe it. If a man approached me with the body language that they used on stage in Tokarczuka, these male impersonators, I would be afraid that someone was about to punch me in the face. It's highly stylized, but in particular, the way that Gene Kelly grunts while they're dancing in their sort of hermaphroditic garb, because it's very male, but at the same time, these women they're still shaped like women.
Yeah.
They shout and grunt and emphasize in this guttural, very vocal fashion. I've never seen that anywhere outside of a Gene Kelly movie.
Oh, yeah, because they're like, huh!
Yeah, they're, ha! Huh! Ah!
I've seen it in kung fu movies.
Well, kung fu movies, but that's also not musical theater, far as I know.
Because we're in China.
Well, in China, it was opera initially.
Opera stage fighting?
It comes from, kung fu comes from Chinese opera. But so you have in Tokarczuka the two, it's really three acts, but it's one narrative play and then a musical review. In fact, Aaron said that it was a one-act play. Actually, it wasn't a one-act play. It was a two-act play. But it's still very strange to see that format, because in America, typically you have a three-act play or a one-act play. A two-act play, you know, either you have beginning, middle, and end in one act, or a beginning, a middle, and an end. But a beginning and an end...
I kind of said it was... I said it was one act because the intermission came at the end of it.
That's true.
Because usually when I think of two-act plays, I think of the intermission as being in the middle.
Well,
but you're saying there was an act break and they just
there
didn't
was
have
an act
intermission.
Break, and you may recall it. It's when they changed the set. They changed the set the first time. They
was
brought
there
down
a time
the curtain.
Jump too?
There was a time jump.
Okay, and then they show that the Eiffel Tower was like
yes.
partly constructed. Okay,
right.
Yeah. So narratively, it was Act Two.
Just to give you a bare bones description of the plot.
Oh yeah,
of
because
this narrative.
We didn't speak enough Japanese. Then.
No, like, we didn't really pick up on a lot of it. In fact, I didn't realize at the time. I didn't realize that it was a two-act play. So in my head, after it was over, I was still contriving how it was going to end.
Yeah, and it was kind of an ambiguous ending. Like, I kind of expected, like, there might be a little more of the story as well. But we'll get into that.
Right.
If you want to, are you going to tell the plot?
Yeah, I'm going to tell the plot. There are two brothers. They are con artists, and they roll into 19th century Paris prior to the construction of the Eiffel Tower in time to discover that there is a contest for the development of a great work of art. They are basically lecherous and rakes. They are there to swindle the gentry and blow out of town, and this is what they do. At the same time, this contest is entered by a young inventor who is socially awkward.
But a genius
and seems to have a pure heart. He falls in love with a girl.
Oh, the flower girl.
Yes,
she's the girl, who goes around with a flower cart delivering flowers, like in My Fair Lady or something.
Yes. Well, she's high class. Yeah. She's not Eliza Doolittle. She's
I was thinking of famous flower girls
just,
from films.
Yeah, she's a romantic ideal of the shop girl.
Yeah, she's innocent and blah, blah.
Yes, and blah, blah. One of the elder brother sweeps her off her feet, steals her heart, and over the course of the play, they attempt to run away with the money that has been earmarked for the inventor's project of the Eiffel Tower, but wackiness ensues, and instead they decide to go honest because, in fact, the elder brother has fallen in love with the flower girl, even though he was just a cad and a rake before.
A rake?
Yeah.
Does anyone say that besides you?
I don't know.
Anyway, go ahead.
Probably. Maybe not under age of 60.
I don't know if anyone say it out loud, but...
What about the rake's progress?
What is that?
Never mind.
Oh, sorry, I didn't go to school.
Read a book. No.
This.
So, at the end of the play, the two brothers have returned the money and are leaving town before they can get caught by the constabulary. How do you like that?
Now you're just being a jerk. I assumed a rake was just like a skinny guy, like a punk singer.
No, a rake is like a fop. A rake is...
Now use the Yiddish term.
He's a schlemiel. No, he's not a schlemiel. He's a schmendrick. A rake is... a Don Juan who courts all the girls and steals their hearts and betrays them, and wherever he goes, there's a trail of broken hearts, and he's
like a Rolling Stone.
He's like a Rolling Stone. So where was I? Okay, so the flower girl pursues
straight.
The elder brother,
yeah,
and says, "No, take me with you. I love you. I'm never going to forget you." And
to the wrong brother.
To the mean one. To the elder brother.
Which one was the jerk?
The jerk was the elder brother.
Okay, so she falls for the jerk.
Well, yes. The jerk also happens to be the protagonist.
Yeah.
But never mind that.
Well, I thought she should have fallen for the scientist.
Well, the scientist was in love with her.
Yeah.
But she didn't really. However, the elder brother turns around and says, "No, if you come with us, your life is going to be miserable because we're con artists, we're wanted criminals."
And they're both in love with her.
Yes, they're both in love with her, but that doesn't really have any dramatic weight.
But it would be a bummer of a road trip. We got two broke criminals and who are in love with the same chick who's with them.
So they say, "Go to the inventor because he's so much better for you.
Yes.
You may not love him, but he loves you. We're just going to wander off into the distance."
Into the sunset.
That's what happens. The brothers leave with the shop girl's heart.
Yeah, and she's kind of like, "I'll always love you."
Yeah.
And that's it.
And that's a beautiful ending to the Japanese.
The curtain comes down, and we're like, "All right, so in Act Two, we're going to straighten this out, and she's going to get with someone."
Right, and I explained to Aaron what would happen if this were an American or indeed an English play, where in the third act, someone arrives that no one is expecting. Things are eventually set right.
Oh, you said it would be someone like who'd come in and be like, "I'm the real so-and-so."
Right,
It wasn't the con artist.
I'm
the real guy and I have proof. And then they would find out the con artist and catch them.
Yep.
Then jail the con artist.
Right.
And she would get with the scientist, the younger brother?
She would probably get with the scientist.
So they would have made that a little bit stronger. I think she would have kept rejecting the jerk, except for maybe in one scene.
She could have... The jerk could have stolen her heart until she finds out who he really is. And you have to understand that these con artists, they really are anti-heroes throughout. They're doing the wrong thing. They're bad people.
Yeah.
This is not a lovable lout scenario.
No, they're not actually redeemable. They do take...
They really are criminals.
Do they leave the money behind at the
end? Yes, they leave the money behind.
Yeah.
They leave a note explaining what they did and that they're sorry, but they leave to continue their life of vagabondry as scoundrels and raconteurs.
Yes, but the Japanese guy who we saw this with assured us that to any Japanese person watching the play, I mean, it sure helps that they speak the language, but also they would be satisfied with the ending.
Yes.
Which was a totally unacceptable ending by any American stretch of the imagination. But it kind of made a lot of things made sense, where it is that sort of ending that you're supposed to think about it. Like, it's not spelled out for you that she'll get together with a scientist, and you can kind of decide on your own whether or not she'll get with the right guy, or if she'll just die alone. Who knows? Like, it's up to you, the viewer.
The story is concluded, but not in a pat way.
Yeah.
So that was the first half, or the first two thirds. And
there was kind of like an opening unrelated music number, and then they went ahead with
that
the
play. Right, that would take the...
an overture.
Yes, thank you. The overture. You come in, and you're introduced to all of the different motifs before the curtain goes up. And so that's what they did. They introduced their company and did a little number before things get started to sort of settle you in.
Yep.
So then it was a musical review with all of the things that have not been seen in America since the 1940s that died in America in the 1940s.
Do you want to qualify those things?
Yes. I'm talking about the Follies. I'm talking about the giant sequined outfits with peacock feathers.
Is that what that's what the Follies are? There's like a specific show, right? The Ziegfeld Follies?
Well, the Ziegfeld Follies, which but it was
I only know about Ziegfeld Follies from... Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
The Young Indiana Jones...
Oh, right.
The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles episode, the Mystery of 1920, which was shown as a TV movie in maybe 1992.
But there's definitely a Follies era. Which is sort of 1920s to, I don't know when it dies out, probably with the Second World War, maybe just after.
So they just take all the musical, like the hits from the day, and put it into one play? Is that what the Follies are kind of like?
Well, no, the Follies, it's a dance review with extravagant costumes and elaborate choreography.
It's a dance review. Do they take dances from different shows and just condense it into one show, like in Singin' in the Rain? Because that's what I assumed was happening. Like, every time they had, like, a dance that they did in Takarazuka, I assumed it was an actual number.
I don't think that...
From a different play.
No, I don't think that that's necessarily...
The case.
No, I wouldn't say that it's a review. I see what you're saying. No, it's not like a review like that. Like,
okay,
we have
so normally
sort
review
of a mashup.
Like a greatest hits.
Yeah, I think that... I mean, I could be using the term incorrectly, but I certainly think that you could call Ziegfeld Follies a musical review, and they're not; those are original pieces that they're doing. Maybe not always.
So it's a review of original pieces that are not seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
So how's a review?
Well,
R-E-V-U-E?
Yeah.
So it's different. Anyway.
It's a tableau vivant, if you will. It's a number of episodic pieces which are strung together not by a narrative, but by perhaps... I don't know.
We'll find out when the theater majors write into us.
I suppose. It's unified by...
Nothing.
I guess, you know, well, it's unified by an aesthetic sensibility, which is this over-the-top sort of decadent, extravagant...
Like in Singin' in the
Rain. Lights and... No, Singin' in the Rain would not... although in the background of Singin' in the Rain
is
kind of
a series of disparate music numbers, like... There's no plot in the second half. It's just a bunch of dance numbers from different stuff. It's based on a popular 1920s songbook.
It's shoehorned into a narrative where Ziegfeld Follies would not. It's just a bunch of dance numbers.
Yep.
And that's what we saw. But whereas you could not have this in America without at least a hint of irony, if indeed not tongue placed firmly in cheek, in Japan, there is no irony.
At least not in Takarazuka.
And so when they announced the fancy dance, and everyone came out with sequins and top hats, and this was the real thing. And this is the closest, I think, that I will ever come to seeing a 1920s Ziegfeld Follies.
Yeah, because in the 20s, when people came out in giant feathered costumes, it was not, ironically, and it was not campy like it is in Vegas.
Yeah. It was dead serious.
It was the real deal.
That was culture.
Modern art, nonsense, theater. Only they didn't think it was nonsense. And now nobody on Broadway would do that.
No. And indeed, well, nobody on Broadway, as far as I'm concerned. American theater is dead, as far as I'm concerned.
Sorry, theater
Musical
majors.
Theater, yeah, sorry, theater majors. But you may very well have known
school.
That or appreciated that. I've never known a theater major go into theater for theater. I've only known theater majors go into theater for attention and sex.
If you're a guy, this works especially well.
It works.
The theater major is filled with, especially, okay, NYU has a world-renowned musical theater program. And I will tell you, any straight male in the musical theater program had his ultimate pick of girlfriends, like in a serious 20-30-1 ratio, because most guys who go into the musical theater majors, totally gay. So like the three straight guys in any 1 year of the program are practically married by the time they get out, because it's all mostly straight chicks who are after them.
Your mileage may vary.
I'm just saying from the one guy who I heard about.
I did all right in high school. I'm just saying. Yeah.
Your high school is a drama
club. I did okay. I did okay. For being a nerd, I did all right.
Bada boom. I know. It's inappropriate. Waka chica.
Yeah, I'm not...
There was no drama club in my high school. And if there was, I would have been in it. It's sad, but true.
Well, you were in the band. And this is a little known fact for people who are keeping score at home, I guess. I used to be an actor. And when I was in high school, I considered very seriously doing it professionally. Once I got out and I considered going to acting colleges.
The only movie Noah starred in was The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And if you ever see it, there's a dude in it who looks exactly like Noah. He traveled back in time. 3 years from now, you'll get in a time machine and go and star in that movie in 1974.
All right. To be clear, I'm not actually in that movie.
He looks just like Noah.
My scene ended up on the cutting room floor. So, no, it's not.
The 1988 film, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. But still, you were only like...
Yeah, in 1974, it hadn't been written yet. Whoops. And Kundera was still in Czechoslovakia.
Don't worry about that.
Right. So what I wanted from theater was what the Japanese are doing in theater.
Militaristic precision and attention to detail.
That's part of it.
No room for mistakes or irony.
But lots of room...
They're serious.
Lots of room for real, earnest human emotion. And we just watched the end of the drama...
Nodame Kantevile.
And it really underscores this idea that you do it with your whole heart. And it's something that comes up a lot in anime and I think particularly in shonen series about moto. You know, more. Moto. It's not enough. It's never enough. You keep doing it. You know,
yeah.
More anguish. More joy. More love. More humanity. And it's very serious, and it brings a tear to my eye watching Nodame, because in this country, we don't believe in that anymore. We maintain an ironic distance from anything, because that way, you don't actually have to worry about putting your ass on the line. You don't have to worry about actually getting involved in some way.
And you're never embarrassed, because it wasn't really what you
believed in. And you're never embarrassed.
You're
never embarrassed. You can always maintain a cool distance. But then what's the point? Hipsters make my heart cry. Because, in fact, I worked with a self-identified hipster about 3 years ago.
It's like you have to come out of a hipster closet.
With
your vintage
shirt. Well, it's one thing if I call someone a hipster. Maybe there are many different definitions of hipster, which we've gone over before.
I think there might be a range of hipsters.
But, fine, there's a range of hipsterdom, but this guy was proud to say, yes, I'm a hipster.
Okay.
And he said, it is good and right to have a certain distaste for anything earnest. And this seemed to be what he really believed. He was, you know, extremely sarcastic and... You always thought that he was laughing at you behind your back. And that seems to me like it sucks. And maybe that's why I'm attracted to a lot of Japanese aesthetic. I was prepared to really hate Takarazuka. I was prepared to go in there and it was just going to be a lot of moe, really.
Strap on that morpher and keep that communicator on standby, for the time has finally come.
Back to action.
The first ever convention dedicated to the legacy of the Power Rangers has finally arrived in downtown Los Angeles as the Power Morphicon, with featured guests like Johnny Ambosh, Aaron Cahill, Polly Schreier, Matt Austin, Emma Lahana, and many more, only at the Power Morphicon, June 22nd through 24th at the Wilshire Grand Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information, check out www.powermorphicon.org.
Yeah, let's blast them!
Smash them! And crush them!
Now I'm talking to you from over here.
Something
we haven't really mentioned yet is that many of the Takarazuka actresses who play the male roles have an enormous fangirl following, except these fangirls are usually housewives in their 40s.
And also Paul Starr from Honolulu, Hawaii.
And Paul Starr, to whom we dedicate this episode, I think that we are of the same mind, he and I, on Takarazuka.
No, because he said the girls were hot.
Well, that's true. I didn't really... Maybe that's not my thing.
You were not actually attracted to them.
I was not attracted to them.
They were sort of in the nosebleed seats.
They didn't do it for me. But, you know, very little does, I'm afraid. What?
Present company excluded.
Yeah, present company excluded. What? Such a look. Such a look. Or as they say in the most recent episode of Rome, something that I will remember forever, she looks at you like Medusa on the rag.
Oh!
I like that a lot.
Zing of the day.
Zing of the day to Rome. Where am I going with this? Yes, the fangirls. So I was prepared for it to be just sort of empty fetish with no real substance behind it. And I was totally wrong. It was immediately apparent to me that even though this was as far from naturalistic theater as you can get, it's certainly highly stylized,
yeah.
Which I tend not to go for, really. I lay my cards on the table when I say I am 100% a Gene Kelly man. I am 100% for naturalistic acting in theater and film. The stuff that sort of falls outside that range, well, that's one of the reasons why I watch anime.
Oh, I like both. Like, I'll go for the Fred Astaire stylized thing, but I can also appreciate Gene Kelly in a totally different way. So it's sort of like I'm interested in super realistic theater as well as hyper stylized theater. I can go either way.
Well, I want to punch Fred Astaire in the face. He's elitist, and that's what it's about.
I'm kind of an elitist.
I'm kind of an elitist too.
That's why we have a podcast
together. Yes, that's why we have a podcast together. But I am not such an elitist that I will not let you on the stage. There is just something so off-putting about him to me, and I don't know what to say. Most of the people I have ever met who really enjoy 50s musical theater, American musical theater, mm-hmm. they're all Fred Astaire fans, and they love the facade, and they love the glitz.
Well, maybe they haven't seen An American in Paris, because that was pretty impressive to me.
No,
all of the narrative stops.
I worked for a theater nonprofit in New York for a year and a half, and I had at one point or another, I think, the conversation with everyone working there, Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire, and I was the only Gene Kelly guy.
And then you were fired.
I was also one of very few straight men. And that may, I don't know, that may have something to do with it. It was certainly true.
Yeah, because for Fred Astaire, it's like a gentleman's aesthetic.
Yes.
It's like we're in high school host club.
Yeah. And
they're going for a certain look, a certain style, a certain clean-cut attitude.
He is asexual.
Yeah.
And he moves, I think, particularly with the white gloves and his sort of hand choreography. Very feminine. It's very sleek. Just thinking about it makes my stomach turn.
Metrosexual.
Yeah. Fred Astaire, I think, would certainly qualify as metrosexual.
When the guys on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy make you over, they're not making you over to look like Gene Kelly.
No. No, they're not. Or very rarely. Only if you just couldn't possibly pull off Fred Astaire will they go for Gene Kelly.
Right.
But even then, they'll probably try and stick you with a Fred Astaire attitude. But Takarazuka, very neatly dovetails the two styles into a wholly original kind of theater, the likes of which I've, you know, never seen before. Who knew? I'm excited by the prospects of going back and seeing it, you know, another show sometime.
Yeah, it was just like my expectations were very different, I guess, I kind of expected to enjoy it, ironically, because if you just look at Takarazuka posters, it looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, with their stage makeup on, the way they look close up in photos and probably on their website and on covers of DVDs, it looks just silly. Like, can you believe these people? But it is stage makeup. So when you see it from, you know, your balcony seat,
right.
It obviously doesn't look that ridiculous. Because a lot of times their makeup is made, if they're doing a play, a Western play, not a Japanese play, they've got this really heavy eyeshadow on to try and make their eyes look more like Caucasian eyes, mm-hmm. and not like Japanese eyes. Mm-hmm. So up close, that looks stupid. But from far away, you can't really tell. And it does whatever theater makeup is supposed to do. Makes their eyes look
right.
And wider or whatever.
Accentuates the features of the face. You can see them from the nosebleed seats.
Yeah.
Which otherwise, you wouldn't be able to.
Like, maybe if I'd heard a clip from one of their performances, and I don't think I had. I expected an ironic enjoyment. And it was hard kind of not to laugh a little bit when the giant champ dance neon sign came down. And a couple of the costumes were kind of goofy looking, like they came from some other era. But they were really well put together. And in the context of the dances they were doing, it all made sense.
And I guess there's a third element. I think that Takarazuka would be, at least the review that we saw, would be vastly different, but for Bob Fosse and the Fosse style of choreography.
Yeah, I was going to try and bring up Fosse earlier. It's like the most stylized kind of theater.
Well, stylized, but just extraordinarily dynamic, where every part of your body...
Right, for non-theater listeners, Fosse, if you saw the movie Chicago, that's like Bob Fosse style. Of strange choreography of people with white gloves looking like they're dancing with no kind of forces of gravity acting on them. And it's supposedly impossible to choreograph, like, to look at his dances the way they were written down and try and reperform them. Like, no one can read them.
Well, he was a legitimate genius of a choreographer, and I don't think there's anyone who, you know, has come close since.
Yeah.
There's just such sort of Spartan movements, but at the same time, those movements are...
They're weird.
they're so big.
And they're not,
you know?
They're just really unnatural movements, too. Like, it's not the way, it's making people move in a way that humans do not usually move.
Yeah, and I'm suffering from some kind of the old saying that writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
Yeah.
Trying to describe a dance.
A radio show about dance.
Right. Very...
Not easy.
Very challenging.
Yeah.
Certainly. If you had a doujin and you mashed up the Ziegfeld Follies with Bob Fosse choreography, you'd have a really good idea. And you'd reverse gender casting, of course.
Right, right.
You have a really good idea of what Takarazuka is.
Turn on the reverse gender filter.
I don't think the West has anything that comes close to that.
No.
Now.
And they're all taking it so seriously. Like, it's really, really hard to get into Takarazuka. And once you do, like, you live there in their little colony and it's your whole life.
Right.
And actually, when it comes to the fan communities, we thought it was just like a thing, like fans spontaneously show up or whatever. No, there are big companies that buy the actress, organize groups of fans to go to plays, and they get blocks of tickets on discount. And then they can go to dinner parties where they get to meet their actor or whatever. So it's a very organized activity, like in a group. So you end up belonging to fan clubs for specific actresses.
Right, which is also Japanese style.
Which is very Japanese style. Because
if
you're not in a group, then whatever.
Then
no purpose to live, I guess.
Well, then you will be.
You will be.
You will be.
Then you are in a group, even if you're trying not to be.
The nail sticking up will be hammered down.
Japanese style.
Japanese style.
We'll have another episode where we talk about how we felt like we didn't fit in at all.
Yeah, it was rough.
Because
it's
always
rough for us.
Yeah.
Except in Osaka, which I
Osaka,
thought was...
where the attitude of Osaka is more like the attitude in New York.
Yeah.
I guess we should cover that in a later show.
I'm sure.
But as New Yorkers, we felt very at home in Osaka. Also, I can see now where, having gone to Tokyo, people from Tokyo come to New York, and they like it very much. And I think from the Tokyoites' mindset, New York is a very quaint and very small city. So they enjoy it, because it's just about, you know, good food and some high society and... Like, everything looks older than it looks in Tokyo, because it is. Because our city wasn't destroyed by earthquakes and bombs.
Yes, that's true.
Or Godzilla. But to American tourists, New York is bewildering, overwhelming, huge,
terrifying.
Snobby, terrifying, horrible, like, fast-paced. They can't take it. But compared to Tokyo, rats everywhere. Compared to Tokyo, New York is, like, much more laid back.
Yeah.
It's calmer, a little bit slower, a little less crowded. Whereas Americans from elsewhere in the country are just like, Jesus, the crowds! It's nothing compared to Tokyo.
Although
crowds. I no longer fear Times Square at rush hour because I've been to those stations in Tokyo.
Yeah,
it was
worse.
Hour.
Whereas in New York, going from one crowded stop where everyone gets on to one crowded stop where everyone gets off, maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah.
In Tokyo, maybe 90 minutes.
Yeah, because people really... Their typical commute is like 2 hours, 2.5 hours. Where people in New York think that's too far.
In Tokyo think it's too far, but everybody accepts it.
In conclusion, even the most crowded New York train is less crowded than a Tokyo
train. Complain about a 45-minute commute, but that, for these people, for
that
your average Tokyo
that would be amazing.
Dweller,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a good deal. That's
like
something
you
want.
Right in the city.
But I must say that I take whatever a Tokyo native might have to say with a... I take their opinion of my city with a grain of salt, as they are notoriously polite, would be loath to complain. Yeah, that'll come up on the next episode.
Right.
And I'm sure we're running out of time on this one, but I feel like...
Did you feel like you said everything?
Yeah, I really did, I hope, a good feeling of the experience across. And of the things that we did in Japan, this was the one that really blindsided me as something that I just didn't expect and was really surprised and you know, very happy about. And as Aaron will tell you, that doesn't happen very
Almost
often.
Almost never happens.
But when it does, you got me for life. So.
Oh, so if you want to watch a Japanese anime with a lot of theater training montages, I recommend Glass Mask.
Oh, both, man.
Both the original from 1984 and the 2005 version are
which
perfectly
I haven't seen.
Acceptable. Now, I am really frustrated. Maybe someone on the internet can help me here because Gerald from AWO sent me an opening theme to a show called Cat's Eye that I guess is being imported. It is almost exactly like the original Glass Mask opening, but the original Glass Mask opening is not on YouTube, only the Italian opening with an Italian song. Someone's taken the original song and set it to the 2005 graphics. That doesn't help. And, like, sometimes people have taken... And then, like, there's... If you look at for the Japanese word, there's, like, another show that I guess parodies, whatever. But this Cat's Eye opening and the original 1984 Glass Mask opening both feature girls in leotards leaping around to songs which are mostly in English, but it's nonsensical English, in a kind of jazzercise workout thing. On a black stage with little stars, and there's no real horizon or set that they're in. It's amazing. Put the Cat's Eye link up.
Glass Mask is... The opening is certainly
that's not musical theater.
Jazzercise horrific.
Yeah,
but it's not, no, it's traditional theater.
But it is like
they
Western
do straight plays. Yeah. They do Western plays, but
except for the one that they're building.
This is what I'm talking about. Where Glass Mask essentially is it's sports anime about acting school.
It's awesome,
which is awesome. Indeed, I really wish that such a school existed in this country, and I went to it. Because that's what I'm talking about. This is method acting.
Because they're so hardcore that if they're doing the Helen Keller play...
Right.
What is it, Miracle Worker?
Miracle Worker.
And you're playing Helen Keller, then she blinds her... Like, she puts a blindfold on and, like, plugs her ears up and lives in a house in darkness
and
for a week.
And throws herself around the house.
Right, right. Breaks a bunch of stuff.
But her acting teacher, when she has to... One of the first roles that she has to be a tree, right?
Yeah.
Just a tree.
Be a tree.
And so... She's there, she's a tree, and her acting teacher, who is hideously scarred,
oh, yeah,
I might
like her,
add.
Her bangs hang over her eye on, like, one side, so you can't see her one eye. And I was like, it'd be great if, like, her eye is missing, and, like, about two or three episodes you get it, the reveal where she pushes back her bangs, and she's been scarred by a spotlight that fell on her, ending her acting career.
But she has to be a tree, and her acting teacher... Like, what, slaps her or something?
Oh, yeah.
And she flinches?
I think she's, like, throwing things
at
her.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Garbage
she's,
or
she's
something.
She's throwing crap at this poor girl. And she flinches. And her acting teacher says, a tree wouldn't move! And, like, locks her in a shed.
The whole show is like...
No food for a week. So she can learn how to be still.
Yeah.
And then she moves from being, like, a tree to being a doll. And of course, each time when they actually do the show, everyone's like, wow, that doll that didn't move the whole time. That's really impressive.
Just stage storm.
But if you can imagine, stage storm personality.
That's
something that
shows
up in other
anime too.
I forgot about that. But it's her and this Little Miss Perfect blonde girl who's her acting rival, and they're both.
And later friend.
And later friend. Not really, though. I don't think they ever really get along.
They get along okay.
But they're both competing. For the apotheosis of Japanese drama role for a girl.
The Crimson Goddess.
The Crimson Goddess.
Who's like the goddess of a plum tree or something. Like when you hear about the plot of this, you're like, what? Actually, there's a live action drama that they made of Glass Mask and we haven't watched. And I bet it's amazing. Maybe it's a more recent drama. Maybe they made it more than once. And also there's like someone decided to make the actual play. About the plum tree.
Yeah.
The Crimson Goddess one. Like, even though the plot is not detailed and never performed in the series, because you're waiting for it.
Oh, you gave it away!
You're like,
spoilers.
When are they going to perform the Crimson
spoilers.
Goddess? No, they don't do it in the show. Sorry.
Spoilers. Oh.
Well, that's a big letdown. I think if you go into it knowing you're never going to see the Crimson Goddess.
That's fine. You don't see it for the climactic Crimson Goddess anyway. You see it for the nonstop actor abuse.
And the Mr. Purple Rose plotline.
And the Mr. Purple Rose.
Oh, Mr. Purple Rose.
All right. I think we're...
Yeah, we're done.
We're probably done. No, I want to end... I want to end with an Alfred Hitchcockism about actors. He was accused of saying that actors are chattel. He said, chattel? I never said yes.
Okay.
Like luggage. Like...
I've never heard that word.
Chattel?
It's like a mix between chatty cattle. Go ahead.
No.
Another,
for
Noah,
reasons that
Noah's
are important, but we will
English.
Not talk about
we need
here.
The Noah dictionary filled with Noah non-standard English words.
Or... You could read a book!
Come on.
All right. Alfred Hitchcock was accused of saying that actors are chattel. In response, he said, I never said actors are chattel. I said they should be treated like chattel.
How do you treat chattel? It's luggage?
You don't treat chattel very well.
Get ready! I gotcha!
I'm going to use this mic from now on. I mean, in my everyday life.